and welcome to the Epic Echo, presented by the Eastern Panhandle Empowerment Center in West Virginia. This is your host, Nora Frazier.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Epic Echo. Once again, I am your host, Nora Frazier, Community Coordinator at the Eastern Panhandle Empowerment Center. Today's episode will take an Operation Oppression approach to the durability of systemic racism, a concept that comes from a speech given by today's guest over the summer. We'll talk about the ways oppression has infected our schools and our criminal justice system, and the ways this pours over into our communities. This month is Black History Month, and our guest is a local advocate for racial equity, as well as one of our very own Epic staff members. Adonijah Gilmore is a Martinsburg native who graduated from Martinsburg High School. Adonijah also received his bachelor's in social work from Shepherd University and his master's in social work from West Virginia University. He has been an advocate for social justice and a fierce fighter for liberation of Black people and all people who are oppressed. This past summer, Adonijah has been a critical voice in highlighting how deep this issue runs and how it has been consistent over the years. I'm going to go ahead and let our guest introduce himself, and thank you so much for being here, Adonijah.
Well, Nora, thank you. I do appreciate, you giving, me this platform, or we having this platform to discuss these, important and critical issues that are facing the nation and are facing our communities and, also affecting our homes. So, I appreciate the introduction. And again, my name is Adonijah Gilmore. I am a resident of Martinsburg. I've lived here for most of my life. I did spend a little bit of time in Clarksburg, West Virginia, from first to third grade. And then I came back to Martinsburg in 2004 for the beginning of my fourth grade year, in which I'll talk a little bit about why after that. But my mom got into a little bit of trouble, which caused us to have to transition back to Martinsburg for long term. So I did grow up in Martinsburg, so it has raised me. I went to Martinsburg High School, went to South Middle School, went to Orchard View, went to Bethany, graduated from Martinsburg in 2012. So my 10-year anniversary is coming up. It's so hard to believe, but it's a blessing to be able to reflect on. But I did graduate from Martinsburg in 2012, went to Bethany for 1 year, then transferred to Shepherd, where I received a bachelor's in social work in 2016, I believe. And then I went to, I believe it was 2016. I'm getting old now, so I tend to forget. And then I went and got on my master's in social work from WVU in 2019. It's definitely West Virginia, stayed around and was able to observe how relevant these issues are when speaking of race, even in an environment that is rural, more rural than other parts of the country, but also in a part of that environment that's more quote unquote diverse as far as its reflection of the people that lives in a space like Martinsburg, but still seeing how racism is still relevant and present, even in the spaces where we don't think it can be. And even in a place like, even in my experience at Shepherd, in Shepherdstown, a graduate from Shepherd University, I've been exposed to different places, different parts of the state, different parts of the world, and there's racism everywhere. And so that's definitely been critical in my understanding growing up in West Virginia, how race plays in my life and just in general.
We do have that in common. I'm currently studying in the BSW program at Shepherd University, so I'm honored to get to share that experience with you. I love your perspective. I think that your voice is going to be really important for our community to hear, and I'm really excited for this episode to air so that the community can hear your voice as it reflects some of the experiences of people within our community, because that is the point of the Epic Echo. So with all of that being said, I think that we will go ahead and start out.
one of the questions that I want to ask so that our audience can get a little bit better feel for, you know, who you are and what you represent is I want to know what your role in this movement has looked like so far in your own words, kind of the journey it's taken you on, whether that be personally, professionally, just what do you perceive your role in this movement as?
Wow, that's a very loaded question. And I do appreciate it because it's you know, it's a multifaceted answer. Firstly, I like to say I was not always this person. I was not always this. You know, I hate talking about myself in these terms because I hate being even the inference or the perception of being boastful. But I wasn't always revolutionary in my thoughts, or I wasn't always. As critical of a thinker or an examiner as I am now. So I will have to say that it has been a continuum of growth. It has been a continuum of development. It has been a continuum of really allowing myself to reconsider things and also reconsider things. My time at Shepherd was significant in this development because obviously being a social worker, we're trained to understand and or try to dig deep into receiving an understanding of context, right? Not just what we see on the surface. Person and environment is an example. Understanding that there is an environmental factors and influences that needs to be considered, and when we say that a certain thing happens and why it happens. So going to Shepherd, you know, being exposed to that and that discipline, that profession, and those professors and those people, being able to look to, you know, how race, how systems, how institutions really affects people's lives. And also at Shepherd, I was also exposed to so many fundamental people in my development that together we was able to bring the Black Student Union back to Shepherd since the 1970s. And through that, Nora, it provided a knowledge of self that I really never received. And also being able to see the same people within that organization and the people that's external that's supporting this, you know, that organization and that student union, it was really foundational into where I am right now. So, you know, I have to look at that in the other situations that I had in my life growing up. But what, you know, to your question of what my role has looked like in this movement so far, it's looked like a lot of things. And the first role that I do believe needs to be highlighted in this movement is listener. Because I have listened, you know, I have sat back and allowed myself to be educated by the leaders of the old, like Fred Hampton and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Fannie Lou Hamer, and the list goes on, and also from the ones of the present, Angela Davis, Bobby Seale, Tamika Lowry, the young people. It's just like there's so many other voices that can teach you and educate you on how deep and systemic this stuff is. So that's the main role that I've taken, and the other roles is I have, you know, tried to put myself out there more, because, you know, in my experience, Nora, and in my as a student and as an activist and as an advocate, I've been exposed to a lot of things, and I do understand that I do have a voice in this, right? And I try to become more comfortable in extending my voice, and due to the people, my mentors like Tony Russo, who have really supported me, Sammy Brown, who have really supported me in, you know, launching out and being vulnerable and speaking on these issues. I do understand that I need to, you know, be open about it. So sometimes I will speak or speak at protest impulsively sometimes, or when asked. And sometimes I have taken the role of being a speaker at protests when invited, at rallies when invited. And I've also done a lot of activism that I think is the most important, which is behind the scenes, the personal conversations that we're having right now, the conversations that is intimate, that maybe only two people hear, that's really powerful in changing paradigms. So I think, you know, my role in the movement has, you know, has looked like many things. But I think the important thing is and always will be listener. I know that was a laugh. I'm sorry.
No, I think that was perfect. And I think some of the things that I pulled out of there, some of the threads that I think are really important for people who maybe are new to this movement or who are still trying to find their role in this movement, are the first thing you said, which is that you have been through a continuum of growth and development. I think a lot of people perceive this type of change as something that just happens on a dime and you wake up one day and you're a completely changed person. But you're speaking to it being a continuum of growth and development that you've personally gone through. And I think another really important part is that for you, your first step was listener, which is a great first step for anyone who is trying to really find out what their role is going to be, whether it be in this movement or in any other social movement. You have to kind of listen before you can find your own voice. And I think that that's really, really important. And that's really great of you to bring to our listeners' attention today.
Thank you. Thank you. It is. It's fundamental to listen.
So this kind of all leads back into my next question, which is, has your role in this movement impacted your relationships at all, personally, professionally? Has it had an impact on your relationships?
Absolutely. And this is not something that is easy to talk about because it hurts, you know, before we even get to talking about, you know, how it hurts. You know, it hurts when you realize that certain people in your life that you thought supported you for whatever reason, I hate to use platitudes and cliches, but when the shit hits the fan, are you still a fan? That's what Kendrick Lamar said. That's one of his lines. And seriously, when it gets rough, that's really when it shows you who is, you know, who's going to be there for you, right? I've sadly recognized that I have been in some ways a token for people, how I have been an image of maybe over the years of satisfaction when it comes to, you know, my playing basketball days from Martinford High School, and, you know, having a successful basketball team in some of those years with some of my great friends to this day, my brothers, and, you know, engaging with the fans, you know, thinking that, you know, that my love, that love that I was receiving was based on necessarily who I was as a person. All of who I was as a Black man, because that's what I am, a Black man. I was, in a way, you know, just appreciated for my talents. And that is a theme that we have seen over the years, right? You know, when we watch things like what happened 2016, 2017, can't remember the exact year, when Laura Ingraham, the Fox News host, had said, you know, to LeBron basically to shut up and dribble when he spoke up about something that, you know, that needed to be spoken up about, you know, when he had taken a stance on whatever, you know, he felt, you know, he was told to shut up and dribble, not the content, what he was talking about wasn't debated. It was told to shut up and dribble, you know. So through that lens, I'm wondering how many times and in how many situations was I appreciated for me just shutting up and dribbling and playing basketball and, you know, for whatever those artificial reasons were, because it had been artificial, because once I developed into my true and authentic self, those same voices that were there in support of me during those basketball games are either silent, so they're complicit in silently and indirectly contributing, to why this is still going on. Or I've also noticed the ones who are vocally in support of the opposition, vocally anti-Black, or are not willing to even consider their Black friend, quote unquote, perspectives, right? Now they find another Black voice or Black person to reinforce what they believe, not the Black person that they have a relationship with, because it's not really about digging to the issue. It's just about, surface level type thing. So I have noticed that, and that has been the saddest thing, because it's not just, just the support systems. It's also, friends. I have seen, friends make just completely racist. Because I told myself that when we speak today, I want to be candid. I'm going to be authentic. I'm not even going to say those people who just are being racial. Language is important. I'm not going to say they're being racial. I'm going to say being racist, because that's what it is. You don't got to say something. I've been very observant on not just what people say, but what people like, the support that the people who's making the statements are getting. Because Nora, it's not always about the clown who's entertaining the people. It's also sometimes about who continues to come to the circus. Right? With Donald Trump, a person is racist over the years, in his personal life and in his presidential life, would he be as hostile and as inflammatory and as evil if not provided the audience? If nobody came to his rallies, he would have to change his narrative, because he knew that somebody is not validating his racism. So I'm also observant of not just the people who are being openly racist, but the people who are liking and affirming and validating and giving energy to these styles of racism. And this was very much more apparent to me, very much apparent after the election, not even just on a global scale. Yeah, Joe Biden won, but Donald Trump got like 77 million votes, which would have been a record had it not been Joe Biden making that record. But seeing how many people in West Virginia voted, for this man, how many people in Berkeley County voted for this man, not even for this man, but for his enablers as well. People like people in Congress in West Virginia. So, who are actively working up from a systemic policy level to against our freedoms, liberations, as Black people to navigate through these institutions without these racist obstacles that we'll definitely want to talk about later on. So it has impacted my relationships, and it has been sad. But at the end of the day, it's always about, as a therapist, I always teach my clients, especially my young clients, it's quality is always more important than quantity, and that comes with relationships too.
I know there is a lot right now that a lot of different people are taking on in their personal relationships, which is why I thought that topic was going to be so beneficial for our listeners to hear you talk about. So I'm wondering if you would be willing to offer any advice to our listeners who are in our community who might be feeling the same way that you are about how to not even combat this, but how to coexist in our families, with our peers and our communities, rather than having to, experience some of the tokenization and the things that you've mentioned have affected your relationship today.
It's hard, because I'm still learning how to do it myself. Because, once it happens, you learn how to navigate it, but there's always going to be a time where somebody is going to, you're going to have another discovery of a relationship that was personal, that you think, may not have been what it is, and it's going to hurt you just like it was when you first discovered the first person that you was like, dang, it's like that? Wow, this is how you feel? Like, this is how you really feel? Okay, I bet. So, you know, it's hard when, you know, when you have those kinds of discoveries. But one thing that I have learned is really to, plant the seed, right? You got to plant the seed, and you should never not have these, you know, tough conversations. There obviously has to come a time where, you know, you realize that it's just not, you know, this conversation, the seed may need to be watered by somebody else, right? There's sometimes where you just like, you've done all you could do, right? You've had enough conversations. Now they just maybe to learn through personal experience, or maybe their Black token friends need to experience, you know, a open type style of racism. Like, you know, unfortunately, sometimes it has to be something that's so open, so blatant, like 8 minutes kneeling on somebody's neck, right? Sometimes, unfortunately and tragically, Nora, it takes something just so visceral, so in your face that you can't have any excuses to provide, no excuses to argue against. Then you're like, dang, maybe I was wrong, right? For example, the protest that I spoke in Berkeley Springs, and I would definitely want to highlight that as well later on in this podcast, but this protest that, you know, me and the other freedom fighters that spoke at that rally and those who attended, one of the things that I'm grateful for, even though it was the closest to near-death experience that I've ever had, and we'll get to that, I was grateful for the hundreds, it was thousands of people who have viewed that, the hundreds of people who shared that. I was happy that people got to see what it looked like when a group of people did something peaceful, right? We didn't, you know, antagonize, we didn't quote unquote riot, we didn't loot, we didn't burn anything down, right? That was lawful. We established a permit to be in that space. And again, it was peaceful. I got to highlight peaceful again. I was very much appreciative of the fact that we was able to highlight to the masses that when you do all the things right, this is still the resistance that you receive. This is still what it looks like when racism is the only thing that matters to people, not what you're saying, right? So, you know, we have to be able to take a step back and not just learn things, Nora, but we also have to be willing to unlearn. And this may not, and that may not disqualify everything, but it may just get you to a point of saying something like, maybe that's not all the way true, or there's more to the story, right? There's missing some context, right? That's okay to say. We have to be okay with giving ourselves permission to grow and develop. And that's what I had to do, not just about understanding racism, understanding all the other isms, but understanding things like, yeah, sexism. You know, I had to take a step back as a male, you know, and fundamentally realize that I have to look at this from a totally different lens if I want to not just understand it, but if I want to even say that I understand it. I have to be able to be willing to put myself in their shoes. So I think that's the first that we got to be willing. But again, I think even in throughout all those situations, through their discourse, there are going to be certain times where there's nothing that you can do and people are just going to be who they are. And I think then we have to focus on the supports that we do have. We have to, again, reinforce to ourselves quality over quantity, and then that helps us. That helps me personally, you know, get through those tough times of when I feel absence of support. I look at those support systems that I do have.
First of all, I really appreciate all of that wisdom. I hope that our listeners do as well. One of the things that really, really always strikes a note with me is this concept of not only learning but unlearning. This was something we had talked about even in our first episode of the year, when we were talking about masculinity. And I do think that it is a part of the process that is too often overlooked. The learning definitely has to be done. But as you said, and as my previous guest, Andrew, has said, and as I am currently also experiencing, because it's not something that stops, there is so much unlearning that has to happen and that has to parallel the learning. So I really appreciate that. I think that that is excellent, excellent advice and something that people do need to kind of highlight more in this journey and in these movements.
Absolutely. 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 And yeah, and it's deep. It's deep, Nora. And we need to talk about it. And I can't thank you enough for how, you know, giving this space, because this is the stuff that's been heavy on my heart. So it's deep. It's really deep. And the answers, the questions are hard to come up with. And I did listen to the episode, and I do know Andrew. Andrew is an amazing man. And he has been significant. You know, I will rely on myself if I haven't said, wouldn't say he hasn't been significant in my development as a professional, because he was an hard director when I was an RA at Shepherd. So I do know Andrew, and you know, I do appreciate, you know, what he brings to, you know, not only, you know, academia with his educational basis and how smart he is and his intelligence and intellect, but what he also brings to, you know, the community and ultimately the world, with his character of resistance and how effective his voice is. So we have to unlearn. We have to unlearn. We have to give ourselves time. We have to give ourselves permission to. And that doesn't mean that, you know, we completely exit it out the back of our mind. Like, you need to still know what a vile, evil person like Donald Trump did, or Bull Connor, or Richard Nixon, or any of these people, or Ronald Reagan, or any of these people did. You don't unlearn, you know everything, because you do need to have you got to be able to talk against it. You got to know where you're coming from in order to be able to argue against it, for one. But unlearning that this is what we're taught is the right way, or has to be the right way. But you got that. But we have to be able to do that. But it is difficult, because like you said, it's been a journey for all of us.
Yeah, and I think it's a journey that we all have to continue to tackle together. And I appreciate your vulnerability here today and all this wisdom that you have been willing to share with us through your own experiences. We talked a little bit about the impact of racism in your personal life and your role in this movement, combating it in your personal life. So now I would kind of like to take a little bit of a shift into the systematic racism that has infiltrated just about every social system that we have in this country, and almost globally in most cases. So I want to ask your take on a certain issue, which is that more attention in the past decade and research has gone into discussing this idea of a school to prison pipeline for Black, Indigenous, people of color within their youth, within the public school system. And I just wonder if you'd be willing to give us your take on that issue. And then if you're willing to kind of tell us if that had any impact on the communities that you grew up in.
Great, cool. So very good question too. And I think it's also something that we need to, you know, fundamentally examine. When we talk about systemic oppression, or we rightfully bring a lot of attention to, and we should always, the criminal injustice, and I did not, please don't misquote me when I say criminal injustice system that we have in this country. But systemic racism also looks, is also present, very much present in our school systems and healthcare, HR departments around the world, around the country, around the world too, around the country. It's present everywhere. So the school system is a place that, it's almost taboo to talk about racism sometimes, because we do know that the teacher's role is fundamental in our children's lives, specifically in our public schools. And I went to a public school all my life. I never had the experience of going to a private school. So when, you know, I look at how systemic racism is present in the school systems, I have to be faced with the truth, the sad truth that I went through mostly my entire school cycle, probably up until I got to Shepherd, for the most part, with the absence of some individuals and some experiences, and for the most part, 85, I would say 90% so, without pretty much having no knowledge of self, right? No knowledge of self at all. Really didn't know. The only thing that I did know, the only history that we're taught about is you know, we talk about slavery in a sanitized way. We gloss over. During Black History Month, we may say a Martin Luther King quote, and you know, quote his "I Have a Dream" speech. The parts of the "I Have a Dream" speech that is, you know, more focused on an idea of unity and colorblindness, but not no attention to what he really got at in that speech. Because when you listen to that "I Have a Dream" speech, that speech would have been called radical, very radical, very much radical, if he had given that today, if like he did those years ago, like it was called those years ago by many people. So when we get our history denied to us, period, or then when we do get it, it's fabricated. We have no knowledge of self, and we have no knowledge of self, Nora. What this white systemic apparatus of racism that we have here, we got to look to if we don't get the knowledge of self and the images through academia, throughout the school, we will craft and create or attach ourselves to whatever heroes that we see. And we realize who controls the entertainment labels. When we realize who controls Hollywood, when we realize who controls the music labels, who controls the news cycles, the image that is put out there of us. That is what the young people are going to subscribe to, especially when you are denying or subtracting the authenticity of racism, which you don't do for your white counterparts. You know, I know who Johnny Appleseed is. I knew who Johnny Appleseed was, and he wasn't even real. I knew who Johnny Appleseed was before I knew who Malcolm X was, right? I knew more about somebody like Andrew Johnson. I knew more about Andrew Johnson than I knew about Fred Hampton. I knew more about Thomas Jefferson than I knew about Angela Davis. I knew more about, you know, all these other figures. Hey, I knew more about Santa Claus than I knew about Martin Luther King. if we want to be frank, I knew more about Santa Claus than I knew about Martin Luther King. So, again, when you deny people knowledge of self, that also subtracts from them validation of self and affirmation in being oneself. So then that also contributes to mental health lapses, mental health issues, depression, you know, and all types of other facets of mental illness, which also contributes to the school to prison pipeline. And then when you examine and consider poverty, when you consider the influence poverty plays on schools proportionally of color in this country, that lacks resources, that lacks funding, that lacks support in the ideas from the governmental structure or the city countywide structure, then you have situations where people are not even going to school, or the schools are run down, or there's no drinking water, you know, in the schools, or the food is not as good. So that when you understand how much nourishment plays into, you know, being educated and being receptive to education, how that interacts with our body, you know, a healthy diet. When you got to consider things like that, and this is all things that have been instilled in me from being exposed to social work, being a social worker, under, you know, examining all these contexts, this directly contributes from the school to the prison pipeline. All these factors in which we have talked about, and there's more, because we didn't really even get to, you know, the intimate interactions that a student may have in a racist school district, in a racist school, in a racist environment with racist teachers or racist peers or what have you. So it is very much in our schools. And if we are serious about remedying the problem, then we have to be able to tell the truth, the full truth, and nothing but the truth. Or, you know, these kids or our young people are not going to have knowledge of self, and they're going to subscribe to whatever idea that is given to them. And, you know, that's going to continue to perpetuate why we have, you know, why this issue is still relevant. And it's in our school, sadly. And I've experienced it. Looking back, I've definitely experienced it, you know, personally, because again, like, you don't, your history is never taught. Your history is never taught in an authentic way. And it's sad.
That answer really, it's really struck several chords with me. One thing that you repeated and that I want people to take away from this is that idea of, like, taking away the opportunity of Black children in America to have a knowledge of self. And I hope that that resonates with our listeners, in that trying to become an adult who is expected to perform in a certain way, to coexist with their white counterparts in society, when they have so much catching up to do, when it comes to discovering who they are as individuals, and then who they are as in going, tracing it back to their roots and their history. I really hope that that's something that I hope that our audience is able to really sit and kind of marinate with and reflect on. So I really appreciate that take.
Absolutely. 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 Yes. Yes.
And another thing that I just want to highlight is that this is obviously a very, very broad issue that channels back into all of our other social systems, as we've said, but sometimes the answer, and kind of how you summed it up, I think, is so profoundly simple for some of these things. And that's just, you said, we have to tell the truth. And how difficult does that truly sound? It doesn't. I mean, it's a handful of words, but it's a concept that our school systems and our social structures just haven't been able to grasp. And I wonder if you have anything that you'd like to kind of add on that note.
It's, you know, we have to tell the truth, you know, not just to our two people, right? When we're like as teachers or as educators or as whatever, but we also have to be willing to tell the truth to ourselves. You know, we have to be able to tell the truth. Everything that we do unto other people, we have to be willing to do to ourselves. You know, if we're going to hold other people accountable, we got to hold ourselves accountable and be okay with continually growing. Be okay with knowing that, mate, there's more to know. There's more. There's so much more to understand, and I don't have the full truth. And that is okay. That it doesn't mean you're stupid. It doesn't mean you're racist necessarily, unless you act on that racism. You know, it doesn't mean, you know, that you're not trying. But the second that you feel that you're already there, you know enough, or you've done enough because of whatever performative act that you engage, then that's a problem. So just that there's if you're really 2 feet in the fight, then it's not just a fight for the fight for our lives, fight of our lives, figuratively, but quite literally as well.
Yeah, and thank you so much again for sharing all of this and for being so vulnerable on the podcast today. I know that it's going to really reflect in our community, not only your voice, but the voices that are too often not uplifted and given this platform. So I'm honored to have you on today. We've talked about the systems and how they play into our educational systems. I'm wondering now if you have any take on this next note, which is that prisons are referred to as correctional facilities. So my question for you is, do you think that there is an opportunity for correction within these facilities the way that they stand today? Just your take on that. This is another question that's kind of been circulating in the media recently, and I would love to hear your opinion.
As presently constructed, absolutely not. I'm not even going to sugarcoat that answer. As presently constructed, absolutely not. And I don't think the problem can be remedied with reforms. I think that needs a radical, and when I say radical, I mean what radical actually means. It means to the root. It's not a evil or vile or word of violence that it has been aligned with when talking about, you know, certain advocates and activists who speak on these issues that we're talking about get labeled under. But no, to the root, there needs to be a revolutionary change in talking about the prison system. For one, rehabilitation when there is so much money invested in prisons, that incentivizes locking people up, right? That incentivizes keeping the jail as full as possible. That incentivizes state-sanctioned violence. How can how can that rehabilitate? How can anyone be rehabilitated when there are architectural structures that don't have windows, right? Where people are subtracted their humanity. And this is I want to be clear here when I talk about this, because this is my mother and everyone, those who know me personally, and I've spoken on this many times, this has been the catalyst in my engagement for the most part in, you know, why I'm so active now in this movement. What happened with my personal experience, or my secondary personal experience with my mother, you know, her being, you know, incarcerated at, in 2004, when I was in fourth grade for 9 years, it was much personal to me knowing that, you know, when we're having conversations, you know, on the phone, and the phone is clicking while you're saying, I love, before you get to say, I love you, the phone just click. You know, so how is that rehabilitation? When you have inmates, human beings, who may have already done 4 years of their time, and it's not even a violent time. Let's say it's a drug charge, working literally for, and again, language is important. I mean, literally, slave wages, fighting fires in California during the wildfires that can never become firefighters, risking their lives, you know, manufacturing products that Americans use all the time that we don't even know, doing all the work for nothing and can't even afford to finish the I love you to your children before the phone clicks off, before the phone cuts off. So when you consider all of those factors that we're talking about, when we're talking about a multi-billion-dollar industry, because the prison system is an industry. It's not it's not mean. I never thought and especially now, you know, looking at it, I don't think it was ever designed to be to rehabilitate. I think it is doing what exactly it was. I think it's doing exactly what it was created and what its intention was intentionalized to do. And it's working exactly how they wanted it to work. So I do not think that it rehabilitates, and especially considering once you do leave, get out of prison, whenever it is, you now are a felon. So when you're in prison, you really see how much slavery has not is still around. And this is what I mean. I don't want to hop around, and we'll get to this. I'll say this for later. But this is what I mean about the durability of systemic racism. You know, some people think that, oh, slavery was so long ago that racism is gone because there's no slavery no more, but they don't consider Jim Crow. And those who consider Jim Crow and slavery and say, well, that's gone, they don't consider, mass incarceration or police brutality, which has been consistent throughout all the years, and state-sanctioned violence. They don't consider, the hostile attack that is being launched on voter rights, on African Americans in this country, even right now. They don't consider how, when you are in the prison as an inmate, you are a slave essentially, because you're working for nothing. And one can draw the parallels of just the prison to being enslaved. And when you're out of there, you're a felon. Now you automatically subscribe to a large degree, depending on state, to the Jim Crow laws that we thought were the Martin Luther King that died in the 60s and the 70s, the Jim Crow laws of not being able to vote, not being able to have a firearm, not being able to serve on a jury, not be able to access to Pell Grants or whatever have you. My mom, to a large degree, she can vote now in West Virginia, but my mother, who was just addicted, and I do have consent to provide this information. So I do gotta say that my mom is the most important person in my life. So she understands that I can say all of this. She knows about this. But now she could never defend herself personally from an intruder, because she can't hold a gun anymore. She can't even receive governmental assistance. She can't receive food stamps because she's a felon. You know, she has to make sure that she includes that she's a felon on every job opportunity that she receives. Thankfully, she's a good job now. She's been at this job for, going on 5 or 6 years now. But, still, that's going to follow her for the rest of her life. So then suddenly, through that lens, Jim Crow has never left us. It's still here, and it's still very much alive. And that is why I speak to the durability of systemic racism, and how there needs to be a necessary need for fundamentally changing and reconstructing or abolishing these systems and constructing in new, because reformations tend to always lead to more oppression in this country. That has been a consistent theme that I've observed.
I'm so glad that you touched on that next point. That was absolutely going to be the next topic that I led us into. Was I actually had the opportunity to hear you speak over the summer, and I've read the articles that have been written about you, and this fantastic narrative that you gave to those crowds about the durability of racism. And it's a phrase that has stuck with me. So I'm so glad that you were willing to offer us that narrative, and so thankful for you again for sharing all of your own personal stories for our community to reflect on. Another narrative that is spoken by people with power, or the people that already have a platform, is often this concept of all of this progress that we've made, which is often unseen progress. Those two things don't really add up, this concept of the durability of racism, but then also this narrative that is being fed that has a platform already about this progress that has been made. So I'm wondering if you think that the narrative of the progress that has been made impacts the way that we view the work of dismantling systemic racism.
Gotcha. Well, I think, you know, if we are looking at the definitions of the problem, like racism, and if we're looking for the definitions and what it really means from the same people who are provoking it, if we're looking at them for the same, if those are the same people that we're looking at to examine what progress looks like, then it does make sense why a person would think that we've made progress. But if you ask, you know, a person who can critically think for himself, a person, you know, who really understands how, you know, real racism is, they can tell you how we really, you know, how things have just changed. Not necessarily have made progress, but things have just changed. So, you know, one of the things that I've talked about when I was talking about the Berkeley Springs rally is that we sometimes have to analyze things in what's socially appropriate, not what's appropriate, what's socially appropriate. For example, it is not socially appropriate per se to come to a Berkeley Springs like that rally, even though it was very much like it. It's not socially appropriate to come to that rally or any rally with a KKK hood on, for example, right? It's not socially appropriate to come to Charlottesville in 2017, you know, with blood on your, with being bloodthirsty and chanting some of the racist, anti-Semitic, just violent things that were said on that dark night in Charlottesville in 2017. It wouldn't have been socially acceptable to come in hoods, but they were. But the people were still there. The same, you know, the same idea, the same rhetoric, the same violence internally and externally. Heather Heyer, the freedom fighter, 26-year-old activist, white woman, God rest her soul, and I hope the stars keep her in the spirit, you know, continue to, you know, allow her spirit to be around. She was killed that day. They weren't in the hood. So we do got to understand that some things are still there, but it's just not socially appropriate, right? It may not be socially appropriate to say inward. Now, there are those people who do, but it may be more socially appropriate to say that there are very fine people on both sides, right? And to some people, they may think that's progress because he didn't go out there. He didn't go out there and say, well, you know, they were right for what they did. He said there was good people on both sides. So that's not as blatant in my face. So it's a little bit that's progress, because back in the 60s, they would have said this. Right. So but the problem is still very, very much there. In fact, there may be a different problem, because now you're battling on ideal or illustrating how that's a problem, but now you're also fighting against people who have this faulty idea of what progress, of that we're making progress. Because now you got to refute that we're not making any progress. So now you're also fighting against people who think that you're just being cynical because of what had happened in the past. You know, so now you're fighting so many different battles, which is extremely difficult. But no, I will think that, again, like I said earlier, one still has to take a step back and say, you know what, it's deeper than that. You know, people think that racism was gone because we had a black president for 8 years, not talking about all the racism that was amplified and was highlighted and brought on the surface from having a black president for 8 years. I mean, heck, people were hanging. We want to talk about disrespecting the flag. There were people who were hanging their flags upside down because they had a black president, but not my president, right? So, you know, that's how can we have progress? And then we had what I consider, and I will consistently say this, we had a tremendous whitelash with somebody like Donald Trump coming in after Barack Obama. And if we want to be completely honest and tell the truth, Nora, and I will always do that, because as an activist, I got to understand that this has nothing to do with Democrat or Republican. This has to do with right and wrong. Barack Obama wasn't even, from a policy standpoint, you know, to the degree as some of his counterparts, as pro-Black. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter. We still had to come with the person who was just the tremendous, you know, white lash. And you can go through his professional life and his personal life as to why. But, you know, every time again, there seems to be progress made. The elimination of or abolition of slavery. Then you had, you know, Jim Crow. Then you had, of course, mass incarceration. Police brutality has always been consistent. And, you know, all the other things that happens when we get these pacifiers, that is what I call them, that pacification, that individuals who really don't understand the scope of the problem identify as progress.
That was a really, really powerful answer. I absolutely agree. I think that your voice just carries so much power, and I'm so grateful to have had the opportunity to have talk about these things with you today. I think that we could definitely continue this conversation for hours and hours, and I hope that I will get to have you on again later on as the podcast continues, because I do think that your voice in this community is so important, and I've seen the impact that you have on this community when you speak, and I hope that this podcast carries that same weight.
So, thank you. Thanks. I do appreciate that. I do appreciate that. And I have to, before we close, I got to say again, thank you, Nora, for, you know, for engaging in this conversation, right? Thank you for your role, right, in this movement, right? Thank you for, you know, being a, not just an ally, but, you know, just a co-conspirator in, you know, getting this fight out there. I like to use that word. I was exposed to that by a powerful sister, Tanya Dallas Lewis. She had told me that, you know, that there's a difference between being an ally and being a co-conspirator for justice. So I thank the co-conspirators, and I always got to keep them in mind. And I would be, I have to bring up also, and lastly, a quote from the great Dr. Cornel West, who was also a freedom fighter in his own right, who I look to, you know, for guidance, spiritual and mentally and socially and all types of, intellectually, and in all types of ways. He had mentioned, I was watching him one day, and he had mentioned a quote by a guy by the name of Samuel Beckett. And the quote that he had said was, you know, how do we continue to, you know, push the envelope? And he had said, try again, fail again, fail better, right? Try again, fail better. And as a therapist and as a social worker, I reinforce that to my clients, because we're never going to be, we're never going to not fail, right? Because we're human. So if we're focused on failing better, instead of we have the answers and we're there now, we'll enjoy the journey of development. We'll enjoy the quest of growth. We'll enjoy the continuum of spiritual development and nourishment that we can receive, you know, in so many ways. So again, try again, fail better. Because we are always going to be failing, so we should be focused on how do we do that better every time, because it's going to happen. So that's stuck with me.
That's a really powerful takeaway, I think, and the perfect way to, although sadly, but have to end our conversation today. I do again. I want to thank you so much for being here. I look forward to continuing on this journey of growth and development with this podcast, with you professionally. I think that, again, I will reinforce your voice is so important in this community, and I know how much weight it carries. So I hope that our listeners take away as much from this conversation today as I know that I will. Thank you so much for being here. I hope that we'll get to have you on again later on down the road as a guest, because I know that there's so much more that we could discuss.
Absolutely. And again, it's so deep. It's so deep. It can't be with one conversation, or else if we think it's solved with one conversation, then this whole conversation was a bit of hypocrisy. because that will be considered progress, even though it is progress, but the envelope needs to continue to be pushed and the conversation needs to be had. Nora, thank you so much. I do appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And to all of our listeners, thank you. And we will come back with another episode soon, I hope. Thank you so much, Adonijah.